Это так особое солнце, именная степень двойка в Англии. Это процедура айдус-таконка. И она еще называется процедурой по социальной системологии. Это не случайно. Вообще говоря, Пит Пуллер родился в Астрой Дайме в 1958 году в городе Нью-Йорк и работал в Америке в течение длительного времени, в частности в университете, который называется сегодня Вирджиния Тек, это значит политехнический университет в штате Вирджинии, и участвовал в создании одной из первых программ по Science Technology Science Technology. И в 1988 году он опубликовал свою первую книгу, которая организовала Social Technology, и в том же самом году основал журнал с тем же названием. Поэтому, если иметь в виду Social Technology в строгом терминологическом смысле, то он является одним, ну, скажем так, может быть, даже главным основателем этой системы, ну, а в более широком смысле основателем одной из конкурирующих программ в этой области. Ну, вот это то, что я могу сказать кратко. А сегодня...
Где название?
The title of the talk.
Да,
да.
Значит, как называется? Вот там написано, да? Да, кстати, вот для тех, кто хочет читать перевод по-русски, он будет транслироваться с той стороны. Если плохо видно, подсаживайтесь ближе. А так он будет говорить по-английски и еще писать некоторые ключевые слова на доске.
Well, first of all, let me thank Ilya for inviting me and to give this talk. This is not the original talk I was intending to give, but it is the one that is based on something that I've been working on for a long time and actually brought to some completion at the time at which the talk was required. I also want to thank Liana for the Russian translation of the text, and I understand this will be published. So if you don't quite get what I'm saying while I'm speaking English, there will be a Russian opportunity to read what I'm saying. But hopefully it won't be too difficult. So the topic of my talk is what I call the transgressive mindset. Okay? And what I mean by the transgressive mindset is basically a view that the default epistemic categories under which we operate are inadequate. In other words, the way we know the world is not the right way we ought to know the world. We're operating with the wrong categories. Okay? That's the transgressive mindset. Right, we all feel it. And it's a particular kind of state of mind. The part of the paper that's been translated is the second half of the complete paper in English. And the first half actually deals with transgressive characters like Faust and Prometheus. And in a way, part of what I'm trying to do in this paper is to give a kind of genealogy of transhumanism, which is this idea that to be human, if we're really going to be human, we have to transcend our current human condition. Right? In other words, our current human condition, in a sense, is holding us back from what we can fully be as human beings. Okay? So, that's the context. Now, in terms of a field like science and technology studies, and some of you will be familiar with this field, and I'm associated with it, there tends to be a kind of view about the human condition put forth. And it's one where notions of the past the present, and the future are treated as separate entities. Okay, that there are clear distinctions between them. And so, for example, Thomas Kuhn believed that the way you would study the past would be pretty much as a foreign country. So that the only thing that historians of science should basically focus on things that are clearly in the past and as a result not in the present. So they're mutually exclusive, in other words, past and present. Okay? And the same, of course, with the future. The future is some other place that we can't write about because it doesn't exist. Right? So this idea of past, present, and future as being radically different, I think is very much part of science and technology studies. So you end up getting Kuhn's position, where you really can only study history of science of a past that's completed. And then you get the contemporary science and technology studies view that the future is, in a sense, uncertain, unknowable, open. It's a different place from where we are, and what we should study is the present. Okay, you get the idea. So these are clear categorical distinctions. And the transgressive mindset denies the clarity of the distinctions. Right? The transgressive mindset is going to say past, present, and future are continuous in some sense and overlapping. And that they aren't so clear. And they will, and the transgressive mindset will say that about a lot of other things as well. Okay? And so, generally speaking, you know, if you want a kind of general definition of the transgressive mindset, it's differences in kind are really differences of degree. Okay? And so, typically our categories are presented as oppositions. Okay? So, for example, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, I think the Greeks, in a way, kind of understood this very well. You have these distinctions like bald and hairy. But they're not absolute distinctions. They're in between. I can see it for myself and in the room, right? And this is the origin of slippery slope arguments, where, in a sense, two things that are initially seen as diametrically opposed, right, end up being along a continuum, and it becomes very difficult to tell where one ends and the other begins. Now, this is potentially explosive, this kind of idea, in context where there are a lot of values associated with each side of the opposition. So if you associate bald with being old and hairy with being young, but then you see that there are young and hairy people of either ages, then the significance of the distinction starts to blur. And in a way, this is how you end up getting into a kind of transgressive mindset, where something that looks like a very clear opposition turns out not to be so clear because the values associated with them can also be associated with the opposite of the opposite idea. So there is this term that's used in political psychology, which I would put forward to you, which has to do with the transgressive mindset. And it's called taboo cognition. And it's due to a political psychologist named Philip Tetlock. And this idea, and the idea of what he did was that a lot of people's notions of let's say, what's left and what is right in the political spectrum, you know, politics is so much defined in terms of oppositions and so forth. But what happens if you start combining positions from both opposites and you come up with some hybrid kinds of views, especially views that, you know, aren't supposed to be thought about, okay? So in some of his examples, he likes to use religious examples to kind of create this idea of taboo cognition. So supposing Jesus had sex, right, what would be the sex like? Right? And how would you imagine Jesus as sexual? Right? And the point here is, right, that Jesus would be, as a human being, has that sort of character, but is also God, and so is already a hybrid entity, and so you start drawing a conclusion from that, which then starts to make you wonder about what's at stake in the difference between the two categories, the human and the divine. Okay? And that's taboo cognition. You can conjure this up in many different contexts. And it's part of the transgressive mindset. Now, in the history of science, specifically, right, we have this kind of idea when you think about, if you think about Aristotle, for example, Aristotle had a very kind of clear distinction between how you understand matter in motion in the heavens and on the earth. Okay, so these two things were radically different in terms of the laws and so forth that they follow. But then you get Newton saying, actually it's the same set of laws that cover everything. Right? And what at first seems like an absolute difference is no longer the case. Okay? So this would be another example of where, in a sense, opposition, right, where you have what's going on in the heavens and going on in the earth as being seen as radically different, turns out to be not so different after all, being able to be covered in the same set of laws. Another distinction, living versus non-living. Okay? Now, here, of course, going back to Aristotle, but also going back into the theological tradition, there is an absolute distinction between these two ideas and what they signify. But of course, part of what the history of modern science has been about blurring this distinction in often quite radical ways. And so nowadays, of course, we talk about something like synthetic biology, which is to treat life as something that one could construct out of non-living things. All right, and this is very much on the table. It's been on the table since the molecular revolution. But still, there are these movements that have existed within the history of philosophy, which in a sense have kind of engaged in this kind of transgressive thinking. So one of them is panpsychism. And panpsychism, right, is the idea that everything has mind or spirit, but perhaps to varying degrees. So in other words, there is no absolute distinction between what has a mind and what doesn't have a mind, but it is a continuum. And it is degree of mentality, what we're talking about. People like Leibniz, for example, the great philosopher Leibniz, talked about in terms of unrealized mind, right? That matter is unrealized mind, okay? And so this is to say, all matter is mental. But then there's the opposite view, which I think is very popular now as well, hylozoism, which is to say that mind is an emergent property of matter. Right? So in other words, if you have got enough matter and it is organized in the right way, then you will produce a mind. Right? A lot of materialist notions of consciousness come from this. Right? If you have enough material complexity, let's say in the brain, one of the consequences is you get a mind. Right? It is an emergent property of matter. So in other words, there is a continuity there too. But it's a continuity that starts from the material end rather than from the mental end. Okay? So what then you would look for is what distinguishes humans from other animals. It's simply the fact that we have a more complex brain or something like that. The material composition of ourselves is somehow more complex. Now these views, of course, were very popular in the late 19th century. Right? And we can think about for panpsychism, Fechner, for example, Gustav Fechner, one of the founders of experimental psychology, right? And for hylozoism, we can think about Aaron Kegel, for example, who was one of the original theorists of evolutionary theory after Darwin. And what all of these views had in common, they weren't just transgressing the matter-mind distinction, but they were also transgressing at a second-order level, namely the science-religion distinction, right? And so there is this, so when we talk about monism as a metaphysical view, right, one of the implications of that view typically, right, is that there's a sense in which matter and mind interpenetrate, are part of the same continuum, and that therefore science and religion are talking, perhaps in complementary ways, about the same thing. Right? There's no real difference between science and religion. They're just approaching the same topic in different ways. And I think this was a view that was very popular in the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. I mean, you see not only these guys who I mentioned, but even somebody like William James, I would conclude as someone who sympathizes with this general viewpoint. Now, when we look at where this comes from the standpoint of the history of science, the area where I think it starts to make an interesting difference is in terms of how we think about human beings, okay? Because there's been a lot of discussion in the history of philosophy and science about trying to come up with some sort of conception of what the human means in itself. In other words, that somehow human is different in kind from other things. But as we see, from many different directions, this kind of idea has been under attack. I won't go through all of them here, but I think one of the ways in which this idea has come under attack has been in terms of ways in which people started to think about God in relation to humans. Okay? And here I think we get into a very interesting kind of discussion, which in Kant, if you look at Kant's Critique of Judgments, right? Mechanism versus organism. These are two categories that are normally seen as radically opposed to each other. Okay? And yet I think one of the things that you start to get around the time of Kant and moving into the 19th century is the idea that in fact, in particular, we may be able to understand organisms mechanically, and so there is a continuity between mechanism and organism. Now, where does this idea come from? Part of the impetus for this idea is a certain change in conception of how humans think of themselves in relation to God. So there is this biblical idea that we are created in the image and likeness of God. St. Augustine made a big deal about this in Genesis. Here's in Genesis, but St. Augustine really pushed this idea. And so there's always been a question about what does that mean? Because at one level, that would seem to suggest that there is continuity between us and God, that there isn't an absolute distinction. And so therefore, throughout the entire history of not only theology, but also science in the early modern period, there is a heavy reliance on analogy between God and humans. And then the question becomes, to what extent is analogy just analogy, mere analogy, or is it, as it were, the prototype for establishing some level of identity? Right? That's always been kind of the issue there. So, now, and here, the context to think about this, when we get to somebody like Kant in the late 18th and early 19th century, is the idea of God as the great mechanic. Right? This kind of view of the Creator, which is very popular again now in creation, right? God creates the world, creates the universe as a big machine. Right? Very much part of that kind of mentality. What makes this compelling is that it does, if you believe that particular view of God, then there does seem to be a kind of continuity being established between God and humans. Right? God is just a better engineer than we are. But maybe we can learn how it works. And if we see all of nature as an enormous machine, very complex machine, but one that is fundamentally a machine, then we, as machine makers, humans, we can figure it out. See, that's a transgressive mindset. Because what that does with regard to religion is it, in principle, makes every human being capable of getting into a godlike state by what they do, by creating things, by creating machines. Right, so it's transgressive with regard to religion, this kind of viewpoint. It's one of the reasons why, even to this day, when people talk about intelligent design and all these other kinds of mechanistic views about God, in religious circles there's a lot of problems. Because at the end of the day, a lot of religious views hang very strongly on the point of negative analogy, where the analogy breaks down. Right? God and humans may be similar in many ways, but they're not similar in every way. And the ways where they break down are the ways that matter. Different in kind. Right? The arguments from negative analogy, which say we can only understand God so much. Right? But then there's going to be these disanalogies, right, where the analogy fails. And that's where God's knowledge is superior to our knowledge, and his power is superior to our power. Okay? Now, my point to you is that in the modern period, this kind of argument from analogy, which is very strong throughout the Middle Ages, okay, starts to be taken more seriously. In other words, people start not to get put off by the negative analogy. In other words, they start to think that just because everything that human beings, just because God does things that human beings can't understand, doesn't mean that we won't be able to understand it. In other words, the negative analogy becomes the basis for science. Right? The stuff that in the past was regarded as an absolute difference between the human and divine condition become the conditions under which you try to find out how to cut the difference down, how to reduce the difference, how to make the analogy a perfect identity. Okay? And what is the output? Well, models. In science, we talk about models all the time, right? And a model in science is taking an analogy extremely seriously. Right? In other words, taking the analogy not just simply to be interested in where it breaks down, but to push the analogy as far as it can go. And that is what a scientific model is. And of course, if you look at what modern scientific thinking has been about, it has been about model building and the testing of models, and basically human beings, whether it be on paper or in the lab or in a computer, creating a micro world that reflects what the larger world is. Okay? And that is the transgressive mentality. In other words, the transgressive mentality does not see the analogy breaking down. It pursues the analogy that we're created in the image and likeness of God to the strongest possible extent. Now, in the recent past, the movement that I think really has exemplified this kind of thinking, which I think is very much part of modern science, has been cybernetics. Okay? And cybernetics, starting with Norbert Wiener, and the idea of the animal, human, and machine possibly being governed under the same principles, the same set of laws, right, and to some extent maybe even being replaceable, okay? It seems to me this is, in a way, one of the ultimate modern scientific expressions of the transgressive mindset. Because here you see animal, human, and machine, three entities that would normally be seen as radically different in kind, now being thought of as covered under the same system, and maybe there are differences in degree of complexity or whatever, but nevertheless could be understood fundamentally in the same way. And here I think we get into some very interesting territory with regard to what the function of science ultimately turns out to be. Because one thing that we know is that the more that we have been pursuing science, the more science has changed how we think about ourselves. All of this has been very much the case. And not least,
thank you.
Right, so as we've made progress in science, one of the things that's happened is we've changed how we think about ourselves. Okay? And I think that one of the consequences of this is where cybernetics comes in, is that the sorts of distinctions, categorical distinctions, that we have broken down, right, between the animal and the machine, right, the organic and the machine, we are now breaking down between the human and the machine and the animal. And this is all part of a natural development of science, but then it brings into question exactly what is the scope of humanity and what counts as human any longer. So there are kind of value issues here on the table, right? Because when we talk about something as being non-human in a negative sense, inhumane, we usually sort of imagine it as being part of some other realm. But if humanity is taking all of reality into itself, then what would inhumane mean under those circumstances? Okay, so this is kind of part of the issue here, and I think this issue becomes very important, and I don't say this in the paper, I'm afraid, is because we do have this thing called the Anthropocene. I don't know if any of you are aware of this term. Have you heard of this term? This is the term that's used by geologists and environmentalists to describe the period, let's say since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where human beings have been the most decisive force in transforming the way the planet is. Right? Humans have been around for millions of years and all that, but it's only when we get to the end of the 18th century that the human imprint, what we call the carbon footprint, becomes so decisive that in a sense, to understand the future of the planet, you have to understand very decisively how human beings operate on it. Right? And so this term is usually used in a negative way. Right? But of course, this term, some of you may know, right, Vernadsky is really the man who is behind this term. And we can talk about that. And it's not so clear it's negative with him, but it's negative the way it's used now. Okay? So there is a sense in which the transgressive mindset isn't just a kind of theoretical idea that I'm promoting, but rather I think it's kind of a lived idea of the human condition. Right? In the sense that humans have already been transgressive in the way they have operated in the world, in terms of breaking out of their own categories. Okay? And so then the question, you know, what this means then is we have an additional sense of responsibility for what happened, and that then becomes an open question. Now, I'm going to close by talking about something that actually appears a fair bit in the paper, and it has to do with a very decisive moment that I think is involved in this kind of transgressive mindset. And this has to do with John the Scotus, the medieval philosopher from the early 14th century, okay? And it concerns the concept of possibility, okay? The concept of possibility, a very important concept. What is possible? Now, before Scotus, the general view about what was possible was what is probable. In other words, based on experience, based on what we already know, what is possible is likely to be some version of something that's already happened. Right? So it is probable in that sense. In other words, what will happen in the future, in some sense, is what happened in the past. Right? And now this is very interesting, of course, because this notion of possible that Aristotle had is in one sense very empirical. Right? It's very empirical. But the notion of possible that we have today as a result of Dove's Scotus, conceptualizable, that's something different. Right? Conceptualizable. That's our notion of possible. That is to say that there are things that we can think about, that we can do models of, that we can write equations about, that we can write books about, right? Those things are possible even if there is no empirical basis for them. Okay? That is a very important point in the modern period. Because what it does is, it sort of changes the scope of what human knowledge is supposed to be about. Because if you look at a scientific law, Newton's law, any law you want, it doesn't just cover all of the empirical experience, it covers all possible experience, even the cases you never experience. Right? So, the scientific laws have this kind of scope of the conceptualizable behind it. And it seems to me that this was really very important, because what it did was, it broke down a very kind of strong distinction. In a sense, this was the ultimate transgressive move. Because what it meant was that the past wasn't sacred. Right? The past wasn't sacred. And the future wasn't just a repeat of the past or blind. There was an intermediate state in which human beings could actually create a future, could actually add something new to the world. Okay? And I do think that kind of transgressive moment, which is in fact responsible not only for the scientific revolution, but also the modern political revolutions, where people break away from tradition in that sense as well, all go back to this shift in the concept of what it means to be possible. And for me, that's the ultimate transgressive move, to think that what is possible is what is conceptualizable. So anything that you can conceptualize to some degree is possible, and thereby its status isn't that it's false. The possible is just simply unrealized, which means that you can realize it. Okay? That's the idea. And I'm going to close at this point. The paper that has been translated is a shorter version of the whole thing, but that's where I end the paper, actually. On this very important point about what the key transgressive move is. And the key transgressive move is this opening up of the notion of the possible, so that as a result, the past doesn't exercise some kind of absolute authority in terms of how people think about the future. And I'll stop here and take some questions.
I have two questions. First of all, I just wonder, and I guess you're right, when you speak about a transgressive mindset, do you include in it not only the blurring of the distinction, but also finding, not only to try to push our knowledge as far as possible, but we find the boundaries of these possibilities. Finding these boundaries in your concept and this only the very idea of transgression.
I think the idea is that the in a sense, the transgressive mindset begins with there already being boundaries, right? Boundaries between the two opposites, right? So and then the idea is to transgress those boundaries.
I see. But
the boundaries already exist.
Move all the boundaries away. You find new boundaries.
Well, I think that's what eventually happens, yes. I think that's what happens. I think that's the dynamic of thought.
Well, it's not crucial for your idea of transgressive mind to find new boundaries.
Well, I think, in a sense, the boundaries kind of find themselves, you might say, in the process. I'm not sure I think that in fact, what ends up happening. So, our conception of the human being, let's say, which changes from before to after the scientific revolution, I don't think that was one that was necessarily planned. Because, right, one of the consequences, for example, was basically the complete loss of faith, you might say, right? I mean, atheism was not intended by anyone who started the scientific revolution, but once you broke down certain kinds of boundaries, then the move toward atheism became a much more natural move to make than it had been before. Okay? So I do think what the transgressive move is about breaking down boundaries, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what's going to be on the other side of that. Right? That's the thing. That's why people don't want to transgress, right? I mean, why is transgression a bad thing? Transgression is normally seen as a bad thing because people are afraid of what happens on the other side of the boundary.
You're talking about past, present, and future, and looking at the boundaries are blurred. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I read somewhere about that, and it wanted to know where it was Francis Brandy, the previous he gets.
Yes.
And then when you pulled with examples, actually, that's how Hegel comes to mind.
Yes.
And more than Hegel, many of your examples would really be illustrations to what I think many people in this room would use to do some, say, 20 years ago. I mean, this. My question is whether if you have some special sense to Hegel, say Martin, and actually one special issue related is that because in Hegel and in this version of Hegel philosophic philosophy, we also have an answer to the question where categories come from, not only because what you don't know, maybe you have another account for them. They can just explain how they, went away, how they broken, how they went.
Yes.
But the natural question where they come from in the first place.
Well, first of all, I think you're right. In the full paper, there is some mention of that, but I'm generally, you might say, a Hegel-friendly thinker. I would put myself in that category. I don't know how much more I want to say in this context, but I would say yes. I think that that is part of where I'm coming from. However, I do think there isn't, I guess, from my understanding of the history of science and classical history generally, I think it's actually very hard to talk about where categories come from, to be honest with you, okay? I'm certainly not a naturalist in the sense that I think it's somehow hardwired into us or anything like that. I don't believe that. But at the same time, I do think the way new categories come into being is about the management of the emergent effects of the transgression, of the previous transgression. Okay? And that, to be honest with you, I think, and I think this in a positive way, is opportunistic. Right? In other words, there are a lot of people, there will be a lot of players, as it were, as old categories break down, who want to then set up new categories. And I think it's an open game how one does this. Okay? And I think historically, you can't, let's put it this way, by knowing how a certain kind of dichotomy gets transgressed and falls apart, it doesn't follow that you know what the next one's going to be. So this may be, I depart from the logic side, right, the logic side of dialectic, where there's a sense in which you can predict already in advance what the next one's going to be. No, I don't believe that so. But I think that should be a cause for a certain kind of optimism in a way, because that means there's always a lot to play for once the transgression happens.
Okay, but here goes.
My question is whether you tried to put another picture, to imagine that we have sometimes we hold dreams on this floor, and will be another picture of sorts. Quite opposite.
Well, so explain this a little bit more. So you're saying that that the people might oppose?
We can try.
Yeah.
To draw another picture. Quite opposite. Yes. Firstly, it will be a floor, yes? And in this floor, we shall put balls.
I see what you're saying. Yes. Well, in a sense, that's what happens when we get new categories, right? When we get new categories, what he was asking me about, where the categories come from, it comes from putting boundaries in a flow situation, right? So the transgression, see, once you break down absolute dichotomy, let's say between living and non-living, and then there's a flow between living and non-living, some other people are going to come along trying to put up new boundaries, right? That's what you're talking about. Yes, and I think that's kind of an interesting issue that we're facing now, let's say in biology. Right? Because I think in biology now, we're in a situation where if it is possible to synthesize life and create life in some kind of robust sense, then you can imagine the Catholic Church, for example, which has a very strong interest in drawing a life-non-life distinction to reconceptualize where the boundary is drawn. Right? Yes. So I agree. I agree that that is a very strong possibility. That is likely to happen. Because the reason why it will happen is not because of any, you might say, empirical difference between life and non-life, but because of the values that are associated with making the distinction. Right?
Right. Okay, we agree.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, the vagueness stuff.
Right now, the vagueness concept is much more difficult.
No. I've read a little bit about this. I don't want to go into too much detail because I don't know if people are familiar with Timothy Williamson and all this. But that was in the back of my mind in terms of how I constructed this. I'll just grant that, okay? That is part of what was in my mind.
What's the main point?
Well, because I do think the way you resolve vagueness is kind of where meaning comes from in the human condition. It's how the vagueness gets resolved, and it can be resolved in many different ways. Okay? And that, in a sense, that's where the action is. Well, that's interesting, though. That is very important, because I think there's a sense in which part of what the transgressive mindset does is to break past dependency, right? People start thinking along a certain kind of line because there are certain values associated with different sorts of positions. So, for example, the life-non-life distinction has often been very much associated with life being sacred and non-life not being sacred. And this is ultimately a kind of religious concept which carries on in a sort of relatively blind fashion into the modern period in the secular world. That's a kind of past dependency. And so a lot of people now are saying you have to break that kind of trajectory and start to think about anew what you actually want. Okay, so I think a lot of these dichotomies are products you might say, dialectics that are reproduced kind of through both sacred and secular culture that the transgressive mindset challenges. You have a follow-up?
No.
I think, look, past dependency obviously happens, right? In fact, this is why people come to believe that, in some sense, the received categories are the categories we ought to continue to use. Right? And this is why transgression is such, a scary idea. Because the transgressive mindset says that the categories that we have been working with from the past do not work anymore. Just because they worked in the past, that's a sunk cost, right? And economics, that's a sunk cost, the fact that things worked in the past. It doesn't mean that's how they should be working in the future. Okay?
Yeah. In the microphone.
You got one right here.
My piece of critique would be that in everyday life, if we regret something, we get punished. And so I'm talking not against transgression, but I transgress several of my life.
You don't need to
regret it. No, I wonder, what do we lose by transgressing categories and propositions? And I think that we move quite a lot. Let's take the position of living and non-living. It does a lot of work in making sense. If you remember, for instance, Hegel Bateson, he conceptualizes categories as two things. He talks about logical types and frames. There are logical types and also frames, which are meta-communication, which are the message, where they have a certain type. And the living, a non-living, the logical type with strange messages coming for example, this living in a living thing makes a lot of work in Dracula. You remember when we talked about the interview of undead. Undead is neither living nor not living.
Yes.
Seems to transcend the tradition.
Yes, yes, yes.
So this is the fun and Dracula of all the working books being undead. Neither living nor not living. Or, for example, dream. It makes a lot of work, a lot of sense in creation and in fiction. So for me personally, it would be rather a fiction. I would prefer it. I would this opposition.
Okay. No. That's a very good comment. This isn't about the undead. Because I have argued that often transhumanists are people who valorize the undead, right? In other words, they would like everyone to be the undead, in the sense that you could come in and out of existence as you feel like it. You know, let's say through ideas of, right, digital immortality, where you could somehow, your memories could live in cyberspace forever, and then whenever someone wants to, you could be incarnated into an android. Right? And so you have this kind of undead in-between state between living and dead. A lot of transhumanists actually would like everyone to have that option. Right? So the undead isn't this kind of, because in the classical dichotomy you were talking about, the undead is a kind of unholy space, right? It's kind of where bad stuff happens. But this is kind of, a lot of transhumanists effectively would like everyone to have this option to be undead. So I do think it does change the value orientation. So this is the point. I agree with you that the value, that what we value, you know, about living and dying and all the various states in between, really change radically if you adopt this transgressive mindset. I think that's true. And so what would be, you know, the horror of being a vampire or something like this would become routine, would become the thing that everyone would aspire to be. Right? I mean, and that would change the whole look of the idea. You see, and I think that is very much, but that is what happens when the transgressive mindset operates historically. Things that at one time seems very strange or wrong turn out to be normal. Right? And then stuff that used to be thought as normal, like going to church, for example, start to be seen as strange and weird and backward. You know, I mean, that is part of what goes on. So I don't disagree about the consequences of this. And the interesting thing, see, this is where I think history can be very useful, because history, in a sense, gives a kind of richness to these kinds of transformations that I think, as we're undergoing them, day to day, we might not appreciate otherwise. But I think the vampire example is a good one, actually. It's a good one for what we're talking about today. We got a microphone here. Come on. Here we go.
Just more technical question.
Okay.
In your conception, conceptualizes.
Yes.
Concerns to conceptual conception and concerns to model analogy and representation too.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about the differences between model and technology, model analogy and representation and concepts?
Okay. I'm not going to deal with the whole thrust of the question, but I'll deal with the part that was most relevant, I think, to what I was saying, and that is the relationship between model and analogy. Okay, I'll deal with that. The notion of analogy in the Middle Ages, typically, was meant to imply that there is a lack of identity, okay? So in other words, the whole point is saying that we are like God in some sense, which implies actually where we're not like God, right? And so that's why when one talks about analogical arguments in theology, they're usually seen as kind of weak arguments. They're not ironclad arguments. But in the scientific revolution, what you start to see is that people take these analogies much more literally, you might say, and actually try to find out ways of making the whole analogy work as an identity. And that's when you get the model building, okay? Because what that means then is you start looking at reality. So in other words, you know, you see two parts of reality that are somewhat similar, but they're different in some respects. But then you say, ah, but maybe because that part of reality hasn't yet revealed everything about itself. Right? In other words, the negative analogy is basically knowledge or reality waiting to be discovered. And so you explore the negative reality, right, as an experimental research program or something like that. And when you do that, the analogy transforms into a model. Okay? It becomes a proper scientific model. And then in a sense, you try to sort of see the world that way, in a very literal sense. Right? The model is a much more literal understanding of the analogy than people who normally put forward the analogies. Okay? So that the negative part of the analogy starts to disappear. Okay? And so I think that's very crucial for understanding the way in which the scientific revolution starts to understand the way the world works. So that conceptualizable, right, is referring to the parts of the world that you do not yet see but could get access to. In other words, trying to make sense of the negative analogy, what you don't know about the phenomena. Okay, that's what the conceptualizable refers to, that other world you haven't yet had empirical experience of, but which you think exists. Okay, and that is part of what the model building exercise is in science. And that's why science always extends our understanding in that way. It's because it takes its own theory in a much more literal way than I think had been in the past.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
You want the microphone?
You know, we come back and see you guys.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I am interested a lot in Serena.
Okay.
Certainly. The first chapter, people get time, performance, form, and time, performance, and beauty. Do you call it from your point of view?
I'm not sure. Well, what are you driving at?
I mean, the first chapter.
Right, right. Yeah. But what kind of a contrast do you find?
Yes, but I think this is considerable.
Oh, well, the Wiener is that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. I actually do agree. I think the problem, well, to be honest with you, the problem with cybernetics historically is a sociological problem.
Yes.
More than a scientific problem. I think, here's the thing. I would say, I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear how you guys think about cybernetics, but I think it is fairly clear in the West that cybernetics was a sociological failure, right, in terms of institutionalizing any kind of, you know, research program that continues to this day. This is not to say people aren't influenced by cybernetics. Of course they are. But cybernetics is more influential, you might say, as a philosophy, right, as a kind of a meta theory. But you don't see cybernetics being pursued as a kind of discipline or paradigm. At least you don't in the West. I mean, there are no departments of cybernetics and, you know, right. I mean, a lot of the cybernetic ideas moved into cognitive science, artificial intelligence, all this kind of stuff. That's all true. Okay? But cybernetics as such, I think, was more of a kind of intellectual revolution, a general change in worldview. But I don't think it was specifically changed the character of science as it was practiced. I think that would be my long-term verdict on it, that it was more like an intellectual revolution. You know, this is not to be so critical about it. I actually think cybernetics is very important, but I think one of the reasons why it's very difficult to talk about the impact of cybernetics is because it was never really properly disciplinized. Most of these major guys, like Wiener, were very much individual geniuses, right? They were one-off guys. There weren't like schools of these people.
There were rather people of a certain generation who were very interdisciplinary, very aware about different developments going on, and they were being supported, but there wasn't a consistent set of students to actually carry on the general program. And so where the program gets carried on is in this, in cognitive science, this in artificial intelligence, this is an aspect of linguistics, machine learning, translation theory, things like that. But the general idea, I don't think, is institutionalized. That would be my verdict on cybernetics.
Sorry, I won't put that.
Okay.
Actually, I have some problem with understanding of your intention properly. The first intention is more or less clear. I suppose that thinking about this transgressive mindset, you just made a kind of provocation, making people thinking about the limitations of their conceptual construction, and making them transgressing this limitation, and this is a purely philosophical test, understandable for me. But the second one is that I would dub as a social technological test. How should we proceed in supporting, tolerating, opposing this tendency in producing some dangerous technologies and so forth? Should we support them? Should we tolerate them? Should we oppose them? This is a problem. And I wouldn't say that I understand your position here.
Well, okay. So he's basically asking me to make more explicit political statement. As Delia knows, I'm a supporter of the proactionary principle. Let me just give a little I think it's the background. There is a distinction when talking about risk between a proactionary and a precautionary principle. The proactionary principle welcomes risk, sees risk as an opportunity, an opening up of space, a break with the past. You know, the way entrepreneurs tend to think about risk, that kind of way. And I think actually the scientific revolution was a very proactionary moment. And the transgressive mindset supports a kind of proactionary approach, where in a sense, you kind of go into the unknown, breaking down the established categories, with a kind of open mind about what might be on the other side. The precautionary principle, which I think is the more famous principle, it's actually enshrined in European Union health and environmental legislation, is a principle that says, don't innovate unless you can be sure no harm will be caused, right? Frankly, if that principle had been in operation for the last 250 years, we wouldn't be where we are today, for better or worse, okay? Because I doubt that science and technology would have been able to make the kinds of progress they made if we operated with a precautionary principle, okay? But of course, we live in a period with the Anthropocene and all this other stuff that I've been talking about, where the issue of risk is taken extremely seriously, right? Where people are worried that if we break certain kinds of boundaries and transgress certain kinds of notions, that we will in fact endanger not only the whole planet, but our species. Okay? So, there's this notion that floats around. Existential risk. That's the risk that we may end up obliterating ourselves. The point of no return. Okay? And this gets associated with lots of different things. So, for example, with global warming, especially when people say the way we solve our climate problems is by geoengineering, you know, messing with the clouds and, you know, creating all kinds of new artificial environments for people to live on, maybe on other planets, whatever, right? That is seen as very risky, okay? But also with artificial intelligence, the concept of existential risk extension. We're so keen to try to come up with computers that can outsmart us in various things,
Right? We think this is some kind of great goal. But this may undermine the human condition as well. So we have this, so we live in a world where the idea of existential risk is very big, and existential risk is predicated in breaking down some fairly absolute boundaries that currently exist with regard to issues involving the nature of human life. I think this is the most important question of our time. I tend to be on the proactionary side of this, which is, but that incurs certain obligations, which is, I think, that incurs certain obligations, which means that we have to, as it were, take responsibility for the risks that we put ourselves and other people to. Okay, and this is one of the interesting things about science and technology. Even though we put ourselves through enormous risks, we are learning more and more about the possible consequences. And so it becomes harder and harder to plead ignorance. Okay? Ignorance is no longer such an excuse as it might have been in the past for undertaking risks. And so while I am all for risk-taking, I think people need to also be willing to take responsibility if things go horribly wrong. And that's kind of where my position is on this. But I am, generally speaking, supportive of the risk-oriented, the transgressive mentality. Because, frankly, I think that is what makes us the beings that we are. That is what makes humans distinctive. We are the great existential risk-takers.
Thank you very much for the presentation.
I'm sorry.
Okay, давайте поблагодарим за question.
The human being, normal for them for something. This rule is so bad. There is a very great difference. Because if we say about risk of myself, it's common to human. But now when risk became global, and there are risks not about my life.
Yes.
It's a risk about and it is not the essence of the human being. I suppose. And so I think that it's not that this logic is it changes the logic.
Yeah, no, I understand, because the scope of who absorbs
about
yeah,
I can risk by my life.
Yeah, but I'm risking your life.
Yeah, it's another thing.
No, I agree. I think that is the tricky thing. I think, in a sense, we need a legal system.